This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
It is always a really great joy to be in San Diego and the great honor to be at UCSD, one of the nation's, our nation's premier universities and the home of so many scholars I admired, have admired so much for so many years, including a distinguished political scientist who once gave me a gift of an A in a statistics course, and I'll never, ever forget that. He didn't give me an A, I'm sorry, he gave me just a higher, I didn't deserve anything close to that. He just gave me an acceptable grade beyond what I probably deserve, Sam Popkin. It's a special pleasure to be giving the lectureship created in honor of Father Eugene Burke, and not primarily because the E in my EJ is Eugene. In fact, some of you remember when Gene McCarthy ran for president, I was always very excited. He is the only candidate for president ever who shared my name. So very popular in a certain era among Catholics. But one of the privileges was to have a chance to learn more about this extraordinary man who would have so much to teach us at this moment. The more I read about him, the more I wished he were still around. He was ecumenical to his core, trying to bring people together despite historic differences. We could use a lot of that right now. He was part of the work that produced the UN's Declaration of Human Rights, which is an extraordinary document that still has much to teach us. He was engaged early on in the battle for women's rights. And from everything I have read about him, he wasn't one of those people who loved humanity, but really had a problem dealing with individual human beings. I bet you met some people like that. He was a warm and beloved teacher and colleague, and we should all aspire to this characteristic described in his official biography. Those who sought him out came away refreshed, enriched, and full of hope. Lord knows what the world might be like if all of us were like that. So it's a real, real honor to be here. And I want to say a particular thank you to those who organized this lecture and invited me to be here, although they should not be blamed for a single word I say. I want to thank Andrew Waltz, with whom I've had the great pleasure of working closely, and was very consoling yesterday when my flight here was delayed by 4.5 hours. Bless you, Andrew. To the Burke Lectureship Board of Governors, and especially to its chair, Father Peter Abdullah, whom you just heard from, I appreciated his reminding us of how many problems in the world we have to solve and how much work we have to do. To Hugo Villar, the Dean of the Division of Extended Studies, and to Professors Ed Watts and Dean Nelson, I have the joy of teaching Ed Watts's, teaching in Ed Watts's class today. And I can tell you this generation of students is awesome. I teach myself at Georgetown, and students give me hope. I always say the one thing you never want to be is a grumpy old man. And I think this generation of students keeps us all from coming anywhere near that. And the two of them are here, and thank you for coming tonight. And thank you all for coming out this evening. This is a lectureship dedicated to religion and public life, and I just have a feeling Father Burke might have appreciated one of my favorite jokes about religion's relationship in politics. This joke was first told many, many years ago by a bishop in Albany, New York, speaking at a Democratic Party dinner. And he spoke of Mrs. O'Reilly, who was a loyal Democrat, voted Democratic, straight Democratic in every election. She had a son who had become rather affluent, and he was called himself an independent but voted for a lot of Republicans. But he loyally took his mother to the polls election after election, and he asked her regularly, and you know, this was one of the last times he took her, you know, how she was going to vote. And as always, she said straight Democratic. And the son finally looked at the mother and said, you know, if Jesus came back to earth and ran as a Republican, you would vote against him. And Mrs. O'Reilly looked at her son and said, oh, hush, why should he change his party after all these years? And I think we are having a lot of issues in American politics because there seem to be a lot of people who think he has changed his party after all these years. I write a column, as some of you know, and people who read it know I have strong political views, including about the election we're in the middle of, and in fact, we have months and months and months to go in that election. And I'm always happy to talk about politics and to express my views, and I'll be happy to do that in the Q&A. But in honor of Father Burke's ecumenical spirit, I thought it would be good today to try to get away from the tone of our so many of our current political discussions, to try for a moment to look past this particular campaign and think with you a little bit about problems we all share and all worry about: family and community, loneliness and despair, the search for faith and hope. I will not be able to resist making a case for democracy before I'm done, because I worry that we use that word a lot, but are not willing to stand up for it, to acknowledge that for all their flaws, democracies in the end do a better job of solving problems than authoritarian and tyrannical regimes. And I'd be happy to defend that further. They do so by holding people in power accountable. In a democracy, there are no final victories, which means there are no final defeats. You can carry out your campaigns and your efforts to change things election after election. And being a small D Democrat means recognizing the dignity of each and all of us and everyone's role in defining the common good. But let's start with the untoward meanness that's out there. And you can just look at, well, almost any social media site. And also the substitution of personal invective for argument. These aren't just enemies of reasoned debate. They're also barriers to problem solving. Important issues, gun safety and immigration, for starters, have become so ideologically charged, so partisan in their use, that reaching consensus on sensible action has become very close to impossible. Your very thoughtful Archbishop, Cardinal McElroy, has said that our political society has been poisoned by a tribalism that is sapping our energy as a people and endangering our democracy. And I think he's right about that. Now, there are a lot of good-hearted folks who want us to be less polarized, and they often recommend what way back in the day we called encounter groups, bring together people with vastly political, different political views, and they will eventually discover their common humanity. Now, Lord knows I'm for anything that might help us hate each other a little bit less, but political polarization, in fact, requires political solutions. Some of them have to do with fixes to the electoral system, including an end to gerrymandering, the introduction of ranked choice voting, easy voting and voting rights, and a lot of other reforms. I wrote a book with a friend proposing we adopt our own version of Australia's system of requiring every citizen to vote, but that argument is for another day, although if anybody wants to talk about it, I'm always glad to make a case for it. But technical repairs aren't enough. I think the way forward also requires citizens and political leaders alike to challenge the weaponization of causes that ought to be unifying. We should start with Americans' shared concerns about family and community. Now, you may be sitting there and saying, family? Really? And it's true that the word family has often been weaponized, especially against members of the LGBTQ plus community. But consider the growth in support of same-sex marriage, now at 71% of all Americans, according to the Gallup poll. When Gallup first started polling on this subject in 1996, just 27% of Americans thought same-sex marriages should be legal. It's one of the largest changes in public opinion over the shortest period of time in our history. And I think that change of heart actually can open the way for a better and more substantive and more inclusive conversation about family life. A fear of reinforcing right-wing talking points in such controversies, I think, can make liberals and progressives wary of saying what most of them believe, and most of them live in their own lives, that the well-being of children is closely tied to the health of families. The paradox is that the best path for progressives to take in expanding on the large steps forward in rights that we made over the last two decades is for them to drop their hesitancy and instead remind their conservative friends that families and family members come in many varieties and that public policy affects family well-being. Many people across our lines of division know this already. There is, for example, widespread support for affordable child care and elder care and expanded pre-K programs and economic support for low-income families with kids. These family-supportive measures shouldn't be dismissed as components of some liberal wish list. They are essential to helping families and the next generation to thrive. It tends to be conservatives who stress the value of having a parent stay home with younger kids, but it's a choice people with all sorts of political views across genders would like to have at some point in their lives if they can have it. So let's consider the help required by the many families in which both parents work and many of them from economic need. And let's think about single parents who struggle more than anyone with this work-family balance. I'd shout out the child tax credit here, which when fully expanded, cut the child poverty rate in our nation nearly in half. It's an idea that, and then we let it expire, which I think is a shame. It's an idea that conservatives as well as progressives have embraced. It's one of those family-supporting ideas around which we ought to be able to find agreement. The House actually passed a modest expansion in the child tax credit. It's sitting right now in the Senate. It's one of those things that we ought to be able to agree on. Similarly, building community is a goal deeply embedded in strains of both conservative and progressive thought. I wrote a book arguing that Americans, all of us, are torn within ourselves between our dedication to individualism and our reverence for community. Paul Begala, the great speechwriter for Bill Clinton, you might remember, tells a great story about Texas politics where he worked, where he said there were two speeches that always worked in Texas. Speech one began, "Our family came down here alone. We did this by ourselves. We worked hard. We created this farm. We built this by ourselves. We were self-sufficient, and that's what we need to encourage in America." Applause. The other speech goes, "We came down here in wagon trains. We came down here together. We had each other's backs coming down here. We protected each other on the way down here. When we got here, the first thing we did was build a church together, and the next thing we did was build a school together. And when we built our houses, we helped each other, and we made it because we worked together." Those are two very American speeches, and I think they reflect our divided political heart, as I have called it. Now, in some moments in our history, we have put greater stress on individualism, and at other moments, we have emphasized community. I think we usually have our communitarian moments when we sense that something is off in our public and private lives, that we're missing something. I think we are hitting one of those communitarian moments right now. So someone I want to shout out is someone who seems to believe that and is acting on it, Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, whose work on this I have been writing about because I think it deserves more attention. I think it deserves more attention because he's actually trying to rally the left and the right, as he puts it, to tackle loneliness and strengthen communities. The pandemic brought home the problem of loneliness, but alas, it was not just a pandemic problem. And by the way, the loneliness problem is a real thing. An American Psychiatric Association survey this year found that about one in three adults said they feel lonely at least once a week. And 30% of respondents aged 18 to 64 said they feel lonely every day or at least several times a week. That should really make us think. Something that should also make us think is Surgeon General Vivek Murthy's approach to this. By the way, if you write about this, it's a real tongue twister. You're going to do Murphy and Murthy and try saying those two names 15 times in a row. But Surgeon General Murthy put out a powerful report last year on what he called the nation's epidemic of loneliness and social isolation. And he said, and I think he's right, that this epidemic needs the same attention that we have given to problems like tobacco and obesity and substance abuse. Murphy has highlighted the causes of social isolation that include the substitution of digital communication for personal contact, and also the decline of local organizations, all of those civil society institutions that Bob Putnam wrote about in his book, Bowling Alone. Loneliness, Murphy said, is one of the few issues that defies traditional boundaries and cuts across every demographic. I suspect you know this. Loneliness is not ideologically determined. There is not a battle in our country between pro-loneliness and anti-loneliness coalitions. One piece of bipartisan work already affecting the debate is a bill that Murphy and Senator Brian Schatz co-sponsored with, talk about unusual bedfellows, Senators Tom Cotton and Katie Britt, that would require social media companies to verify the age of users, prevent children younger than 13 from using their platforms, and require consent of a parent or guardian before allowing teenagers under 18 on the platforms. It's an issue the writer Jonathan Haidt has put before us in his important book, The Anxious Generation. Now, Murphy is under no illusions that worrying about our loneliness and most isolated fellow citizens will suddenly bring us all together, or that finding solutions to ease these problems will be easy. I get it, Murphy said in his speech on the Senate floor. This is a Congress that has a hard time solving much more straightforward problems. There might be an understatement. So tackling a metaphysical crisis like loneliness might feel like a Herculean task. But I suggest that perhaps it takes a Herculean task to make us forget, at least for a few moments, how much we seem to mistrust each other and to try to work together. Calling on all sides to explore common ground does not mean, by the way, denying that polarization is asymmetric. I think the evidence is quite clear that the right has radicalized more than the left, and I'm open to argument about that if people want to. But that can't be an excuse for giving up the effort, because we can't go on like this. And if family and community can't draw us closer to each other, I don't know what will. Now, as I've suggested, I'm as skeptical as they come about a let's get alongism that tries to wish away our disagreements, about bipartisan dialogues and commissions that pretend away differences in a chase after some lowest common denominator center valued more for its location than for its content. But there is good reason to be weary of a political culture so saturated with negative partisanship and mutual mistrust that it makes discussing our nation's most intractable problems impossible. That's why I cheer an alliance Murphy has struck with Republican Governor Spencer Cox of Utah to convene what they call a national conversation on restoring the common good. This small, distinguished, they've gathered together a small, distinguished groups of prominent intellectuals and activists from the progressive as well as the conservative sides of politics, and they held their first meeting last month to focus on the issues of social disconnection, related to social disconnection, including the deaths of despair caused by suicide and drug abuse among those of our fellow citizens who lose hope. I think the Murphy-Cox initiative matters because I think it's a signal that parts of the left and right may be trying, or may at least attempt, to reconfigure our politics around the communitarian themes I've highlighted. By focusing on deep personal dissatisfactions, they're also offering an explanation for the disconnect between so much of the good news of a nation where, as Murphy puts it, the unemployment rate is low, crime is going down, GDP is growing, and the unhappiness so many Americans seem to feel anyway. They initially came together because of their desire to respond to the damage that cell phones and social media are doing, that a problem Professor Haidt has talked about. But in the process, Murphy told me, they realized they shared a common worry that this country feels like it's falling apart at the seams emotionally and spiritually. Now, if that sounds grand or even theological, the specific forms of suffering that alarm Murphy and Cox are tangible and heartbreaking. Those deaths of despair are especially common in communities that have lost their economic purpose. We have had more opioid prescriptions. We had more opioid prescriptions than people in some of these counties, Cox told me, referring to rural counties in Utah. Imagine that, more opioid prescriptions than people. Now, Murphy is emphatic in distinguishing this from the usual bipartisan confabs. I liked this. He said, this is not intended to be some milquetoast moderate all, let's all get along conversation. This is about trying to push left and right into a conversation why so many Americans are feeling bad and some of the really big things we may have to do to fix that. What could turn their conversation into a larger challenge to the status quo are the links Murphy and Cox draw between social breakdown, often highlighted on the right, and the economic injustices that engage the left. Ian Marcus Corbin, a philosopher at the Harvard Medical School and an architect of this initiative, says the emphasis on the material roots of personal struggles distinguishes this era's communitarians from some of their forebears. You pull out the economic foundation of a community, he told me, and family formation goes haywire and all sorts of social pathologies, drug abuse, loneliness, alienation, and antisocial behavior emerge. Murphy speaks of how concentrated power is driving Americans crazy about the fact that bipartisan coalitions are being brought together about breaking up monopolies and big companies, and they're having too much power in our lives. And he also spoke of some sacred places where efficiency and profit shouldn't govern. That's a radical, and yet it's not so radical, because we know that we do not want efficiency and profit to govern everything in our lives. Many of us would be out of business if that, personally, if that happened. Cox, for his part, has pioneered a call on Americans to disagree better. I like that. That's, you know, at a time of division, the least we can do is disagree better than we are doing now, meaning to argue substantively without holding each other in contempt. He expects to have some disagreements with Murphy about the proper role of government in the economy. I just want to pause on that, by the way, about disagreeing better. Some of you in the audience may remember the great historian Christopher Lash. And Lash wrote an essay that I ask all of my students to read called The Lost Art of Argument. Now, we seem to be having a lot of argument in the country today, but by Lash's definition, it's not real argument. We tend to just have assertion and counterassertion that move past each other. Lash says that in real argument, if you're engaged in real argument, you enter imaginatively into the ideas of your opponent, if only initially to refute them. But in the process of doing that, you put your own ideas at risk. And so argument at its heart is an educational endeavor. And he also argued that given that argument is an educational endeavor, democracy may not always be the most educational, most efficient form of government, but it ought to be the most educational form of government. And I think our loss of our loss of what argument really is has made our democracy significantly less an educational project. So to go back to Cox, he will have fights with Murphy on some of the economic things, but he too thinks they will find agreement on the fact that major economic changes to a community can lead to these deaths of despair and can lead to this hopelessness. And that repairing that social damage, says Cox, again, the Republican, will require public action to help build more resilient neighborhoods and economies. Murphy and Cox, and this is one time I'll mention it, have different but not exactly diametrically opposed views on the fiercely contested presidential campaign of ours. Murphy is a staunch supporter of President Biden, whom he credits with pushing transformational policies. Cox is critical of both Biden and former President Trump. We should be nominating different people, Cox said earlier this year. Yet both insist that the nation needs to pay attention to the discontent that Trump has exposed. Murphy said rather acidly, I guess we can thank him for that and nothing else. Cox said that to move forward, the country must figure out why so many voters have used Trump as an opportunity, and I quote him here, to throw a brick through the window. And I do think we need to solve that mystery and act on what we learn. Democracies can founder when they fail to address festering social wounds. I think these bipartisan partners are standing up for the democratic project by insisting that there are certain problems that we simply can't ignore any longer. Now, I think there's something else that might help us. I think we need a truce in our wars over religion, too. And here's another peace effort that might be advanced by thinking more about social disconnection. With religious disaffiliation soaring, especially among younger Americans, there is reason to worry that secular alternatives to religious civil society are not growing fast enough to fill the void. They're growing, but they're not growing fast enough. Even as secular social spaces proliferate, a society suffering from isolation can ill afford to lose any of its community-building capacity. And there can be no denying that faith-based groups do that sort of work. Dan Cox, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and the professor says proudly a former student of mine, reported in a 2021 paper that, quotes, Americans who are members of a place of worship are much more likely than those who are not to volunteer in the community at least a few times a year. The difference is 47% versus 23%. To talk to someone in their community they do not know well, 64% to 54%, and attend a community meeting or a local event. They are also more likely than others to feel connected to their neighborhood and the people who live there. I think what's required to move forward is for religious people to face up to the downsides of faith's public role, and they exist, and I'll get to them, but for religion's critics to cultivate gratitude for how religious organizations, houses of worship, can enrich our common life. On the negative side, many of the public voices of white Christianity have moved far to the right, in too many cases, toward an embrace of a deeply intolerant ethno-nationalism. This has actually had the paradoxical or non-paradoxical effect of accelerating the flight from religion of other parts of our community, especially more progressive younger people. Pope Francis has rightly warned against a climate of closure in which ideology replaces faith. Yes, liberals too need to worry about ideology replacing faith, but if religion becomes a synonym for reaction, many will fall by the wayside. As the traditions of the Black Church have reminded us again and again, the prophetic power of religion must place love and justice at its core, or else it becomes, as scripture teaches, a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. But critics of conservative religion need to remember that community-mindedness is not just a habit of progressives. As Cox's data shows, it is a virtue that crosses lines of tradition and ideology. Now, here's what I find heartening, signs of hope in the conversation. Many secular people and progressives are lifting up religion's socially constructive role, sometimes to their own surprise. My great friend and Washington Post colleague Perry Bacon Jr., who left the church, wrote a powerful essay last year about what he called a church-sized hole in American life. And he longed for a religion of the nuns. He said that's N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S, a religion of the nuns, noting that even attractive secular alternatives did not provide, again, to quote Perry, singing, sermons, and solidarity all at once. In that report on our epidemic of loneliness, Surgeon General Murphy was direct. Religious or faith-based groups can be a source of regular social contact, serve as a community of support, provide meaning and purpose, create a sense of belonging around shared values and beliefs, and are associated with reduced risk-taking behaviors. That's pretty good. Now, it's true that very few people decide to believe in God or not for reasons of social utility. And humans have argued for centuries about whether religion is and faith are primarily good or bad for the world. as I'll suggest in a moment, that debate might be a draw at the present time. But I think that critics of religion should recognize that if they preach the value of open-mindedness, they should apply that virtue in their approach to people of faith and the institutions they build. Doing so won't work miracles, but it might help us recognize that the path to truth and to a less fractious society sometimes takes unexpected turns. Now, even as I make this case for religion's role, I am acutely aware that many, including probably many in this audience, are deeply skeptical. And they are not wrong to point us to religion's failures. Let's face it, religion can create community, but it can divide communities. It can lead to searing self-criticism, but it can also promote pompous self-satisfaction. It can encourage dissent and conformity, generosity and narrow-mindedness. Religion's finest hours have been the times when intense belief led to social transformation, yet some of its darkest days have entailed the translation of intense belief into the ruthless imposition of orthodoxy. But I'd argue that the history of the United States, despite our many outbreaks of prejudice and nativism and self-congratulation, includes many lessons about religion's role as a prod to social justice, to inclusion, and to national self-criticism. So I'd like to offer two views of religion's public role, suggesting that at its best, it is prophetic and challenging, often dangerous to the powers that be, and friendly to those who are oppressed and heavily burdened. The first is from Michael Walzer's fine book, Exodus and Revolution. It's a book I commend to everyone. Walzer argues that the Exodus story has provided Western thought with one of its central themes of oppression and deliverance, of the idea that the door of hope always remains open. Now, listen carefully to what I'm about to say, because I think Walzer wants to call forth smiles of recognition on all of our faces with this line in his book. We still believe, Walzer writes, or many of us do, what the Exodus first taught about the meaning and possibility of politics and its proper form. First, that wherever you live, it is probably Egypt. Yeah, it catches up with you, that one. I love that. Second, that there is a better place, a world more attractive, and a promised land. And third, that the way to the land is through the wilderness. There is no way to get from here to there without joining together and marching. And there is great wisdom, I think, in the historian Richard Whiteman's Fox reflection on the work of Reinhold Niebuhr and Christopher Lash. Both, Fox said, understood that religion can be seen both as a democratic social power, a capacity to build community, and a tragic perspective that acknowledges the perpetual failing of human beings to make community endure. Religion allows people, he goes on, to grapple with the human mysteries that neither science nor politics can address, but it also provides a force that science and politics can call on in their effort to understand and transform the social world. Fox, I believe, explains why we are destined to visit over and over again the relationship between religion and our aspirations to pluralism, freedom, justice, and democracy. Only by doing so, only by arguing again and again about religion's proper public role and where we draw the line and how we balance this, only by doing so will we be able to respect the serious moral commitments of believers and unbelievers alike. Only by doing so will we preserve free expression and religious liberty, and only by doing so will we create the beloved community that was the dream of John Lewis and Martin Luther King Jr. And you can't talk about John Lewis and Martin Luther King Jr. without talking about democracy. And that's very convenient for me, because that's where I want to close this talk. Democracy is not a state. John, and he meant a state of being, not a state of the union. Democracy is not a state, John Lewis wrote in the last essay of his life, published just after he died. Ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting into what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. John Lewis dedicated his life to good trouble. Yes, and we also need to take the trouble to defend democracy in the first place, and for a lot of reasons. The belief that constitutional democracy is superior to other forms of government rests in part on its capacity, as I suggested earlier, to encourage open debate and thus social learning. Social learning is really underrated. Citizens can and do learn from each other, and they can learn together. They pick up tidbits and cues from the public debate and then argue over back fences or kitchen tables in their houses of worship or at their favorite bars and restaurants. Now, of course, this is an idealized view. In our moment, many people avoid political talk with neighbors or family members altogether because they fear igniting bitter shouting matches or worse. Many of you have probably seen this in your families. I like to tell the story of a very dear uncle of mine, my Uncle Ray, whom I spent 35 years arguing politics with. And you could tell how divided we were by how fierce our arguments got. But we never stopped loving each other, and we just kept arguing. And when he died, his kids kindly asked me to do the eulogy at his funeral. And I made a point in the eulogy of quoting Richard Nixon, partly because I liked the Nixon quote and I thought it applied to him, but I looked at the folks in the church and I said, I also quoted Nixon because I thought if Uncle Ray heard it, he'd come back to life just to tell me I knew you'd be quoting Nixon someday. And I thought about my dear uncle a lot in this period because I wonder if we could be having those arguments in this period. I worry very much that we couldn't. So this is problematic in our time, and it's also problematic when we only hang around with people who reinforce our own views and sometimes our own prejudices. Bill Bishop wrote his revelatory book, The Big Sort, by saying we don't even live near people we disagree with anymore. I always told our kids in our neighborhood that even though it wasn't my politics, I really admired people who put up Republican signs because it took a lot of courage in our neighborhood to put up those Republican signs. And social media can push us even further into these ideological silos. But democracy just can't work if we stop talking with each other about politics altogether. I tell my students every year that I try very hard in my classes to include points of view that are not my own, and that I deeply respect students who disagree with me on all sorts of things, and importantly for them, that they even get good grades in my classes. I tell them that in any room, there are majorities and minorities, and in a classroom, no majority of students should ever try to intimidate the minority in that classroom, and I promise to side with the minority if I ever see that happening, even if I disagree with them, to make sure that they will feel free to speak out. But I always acknowledge that, so that sounds very fair of me, but I always acknowledge to my students that there is one strong assumption that I bring to pretty much all I teach when it comes to politics. Call it my bias, if you wish. It's a belief in democracy as both a political system and a way of being. And so, yes, I am trying to enlist students and non-students, and yes, all of you, as democracy's champions. Democracy properly encourages open-mindedness. There's an old joke about the liberal who is so open-minded that he can't even take his own side in an argument. But are we so open-minded that we are not willing to say unequivocally that a system providing for free speech, freedom of conscience, a free media, freedom of religion, and genuinely free elections is both morally and practically better than alternative systems based upon authoritarianism or tyrannical rule? Democracy, yes, has always been imperfect in practice. I really treasure this, what Vaclav Havel, some of you may remember, the great Russian Czech dissident who became president of the country, what he told Congress in 1990, he said, as long as people are people, democracy in the full sense of the world will always remain an ideal. One may approach democracy as one would a horizon in ways that may be better or worse, but which can never be fully attained. In this sense, you too, he said to us, are merely approaching democracy, but it is a journey that we have to stay on. In embracing democracy, as my friend, the historian James Kloppenburg has written, we are standing up for three highly contested principles: popular sovereignty, autonomy, and equality. We are also embracing three premises: deliberation, pluralism, and reciprocity. Now, we know that in its liberal form, democracy must at times resist popular sovereignty. Remember the Lincoln-Douglas debates from your high school or your college studies. A majority of people cannot vote away their own rights or anyone else's. We know that our own quest for autonomy can conflict with our obligations to the communities to which we owe debts. We know that many democracies, including our own, are a long way from true equality. Yet in the face of these tensions and imperfections, which values would we place above popular sovereignty, autonomy, and equality, and also above deliberation, pluralism, and reciprocity? If we would uphold these commitments, we should be prepared with Havel to defend the democratic ideal. We should also be prepared to live it. John Dewey, the great philosopher, said that democracy is a way of life, and I think that is the right way to view it. For religious people, the grounding for democracy is a belief that all human beings are endowed with equal dignity by God. But one need not be religious to insist that on the equal dignity of our fellow human beings. One need only be a small d Democrat. So a devotion to democracy ought to affect how we treat others. And maybe it can come back to improve our public life a little bit. We often have to deal with hierarchies, but we should never internalize them. Those at the bottom of formal authority structures see things and know things that cannot be seen from on high. We should, as Pope Francis has said, seek the wisdom available only on the peripheries. We learn from the experience, and yes, from the news, that the distribution of virtue and compassion and judgment are not correlated with the distributions of power and wealth. Democracy is finally rooted in two intuitions about our aspirations to transcendence, which allow us to imagine a better world, and also about our proclivities to sin and failure, which require limits on the power any of us should wield over anyone else. Thus, the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr's great aphorism, "Man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, but man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary." Think about that. Our desire for a society of self-governing equals in solidarity with each other is why we fight for democracy. Our awareness that tyrants abuse their power and oppress all who disagree with them is why we need democracy. The conservative writer William F. Buckley Jr. once said that he would rather be governed by the first 2,000 names in the Boston phone book than by the Harvard faculty. Now, I think I have a higher view of the Harvard faculty than Bill Buckley did, and yet I think the instinct behind his provocation ought to stay with us. Democracy imposes a discipline. It demands that no fortunate group should ever claim, by virtue of its position or its educational attainments or the longevity of its time in a nation, the unchallenged right to impose its will on others. To invoke the late Benjamin Barber's lovely phrase, the only aristocracy democracy fully sanctions is an aristocracy of everyone. It is the one sort of aristocracy worth praying for and, when necessary, worth fighting for. Michael Sandel's one-sentence defense of politics is something that's been a lodestar for me, and I want to share it with you. Sandel wrote that when politics goes well, we can know a good in common that we cannot know alone. Defending and deepening democracy, battling loneliness and isolation, building community, and understanding that hope is the virtue on which faith and love depend, these are the requirements of our time. We have to do them together. So let us all become part of that great democratic aristocracy of everyone, and yes, let us march. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I would just like to first thank you for really an inspiring and a wonderful talk that I think gets to the heart of why the Burke Lectures are so important. This is a discussion about religion, but it's a discussion about society, and it's a discussion about larger truths that make our country and our world work better. I wanted to just raise a question that I think came out of some of the points that you brought up. And this is a question really about empathy. Fundamentally, I think deep down, beneath all of the virtues that you've enumerated as the sort of points that make democracy function, there's a basic, I think, empathy that must be there. And I think when we look at religion and its functioning, it does an excellent job of creating an experience that generates this shared concern for other people that underlies the democratic experience. And I wonder how we get that in this moment. I'm thinking very much about a contrast between, say, empathy and, for lack of a better concept, cruelty is the pointism, right? Loneliness, I think, can push us in either of those directions. Empathy is a way out of loneliness that is a genuine form of connection. Cruelty is the pointism allows you to remain isolated, but take sort of general pleasure in doing something bad to the people that are beyond your circle. So how do we generate the empathy that democracy requires? And can we do it through religion, or are there new ways to do this now in this moment?
Well, first let me say, some of you may remember that when Richard Nixon was asked a question in a news conference that he didn't like, he said, "I'm glad you asked that question," and then go off in his own direction. But in this case, I am genuinely glad you asked that question, because one of the nicest things that ever happened to me after a talk, one of the sweetest things, was when my friend David Brooks and I were giving a talk in 2016 before one of the presidential debates, and I said to the crowd that if I were to make a red baseball hat, it would say, "Make America Empathetic Again." And this lovely man came up to me and said, "You're going to hear from me." And 3 weeks later, I got a hat in the mail that was a replica of the Trump hat that said, "Make America Empathetic Again." And my son said, "That's a great hat, but Dad, you can't wear it because it looks just like a Trump hat, and no one will know at a distance what you're saying." So I couldn't agree with you more, and I think there is this terrible loss of empathy. And we should be honest about religion. I mean, one of the challenges to religion right now, and one of the reasons why particularly more progressive young people are leaving it, is that they sense that it is not empathetic. I was raised on a faith that was empathetic, and I sort of that was about reaching out to people who were in trouble, who needed help, and in a spirit of equality, that these weren't people below you. They were just your fellow citizens who were hit hard times, and also the spirit of religious empathy for each other. We live next door. I think a lot of my worldview is explained by the fact, two facts. One is I grew up in a working class town where I used to joke that there was absolutely no distinction between party, union, and church. But the other was that I grew up as a Catholic in a Jewish neighborhood. And it gave me a sense of what sort of religious friendship was about. And my late mom and our Orthodox Jewish next door neighbor used to sit down over tea and talk about the meaning of God. And they would sort of try to sort of square their views and see how they were different, but mostly what they shared. That doesn't always happen these days in religion. And you certainly, I'm on the progressive side of politics. And so if I highlight, for example, how some varieties of religious conservatives feel about LGBTQ plus people, it wouldn't surprise you that I'd say that's unempathetic. But I also think that progressives need to think really hard about why, as Governor Cox said, people voted for Trump to throw a brick through a window. I think we need to think hard, for example, about significant numbers of people in the country who, with the exit of manufacturing jobs overseas, were forced at a stage in their life when they didn't have a lot of options at age 50 to give up a unionized job where they were well paid and were suddenly faced with the prospect of making $10 an hour. People who lived in communities that completely had their economic core cut out, and it's precisely those kind of communities that have had these deaths of despair. And what troubles me most, in a way, is that these problems cross racial lines, and yet we have created racial division. The problems that we started to notice because of Trump in predominantly white working class towns, as the great sociologist William J. Wilson said, had hit inner cities, had hit urban, black urban areas back in the 80s. This ought to bring us together and say, you know, these problems, black people face particular forms of discrimination that white people will never face. But when it comes to economics, there are shared problems that we simply haven't figured out how to talk about together. I think a lot of us, when we were young, looked to someone like Robert Kennedy with considerable admiration because he was somebody who could bring these communities together. And I still think we desperately need that kind of solidarity. So I guess the two words that come to mind are empathy and solidarity.
EJ, let me ask you about something you said in your book, Our Divided Political Heart. You said, we are more fearful than we need to be. Do you still feel that way?
I guess right now I think I'm pretty fearful. I'm trying to remember the context of that sentence.
Context? Come on. You're talking. Who cares about context?
It sounds like a negative ad. He said we're more careful than we need to be.
No, but much of our discourse, much of our divide, much of our loneliness, it would seem to me, is fear-based. And I'm just wondering, when you wrote that 10 years ago or more, have your views changed on what we need to be afraid of?
Well, in general, I think that we are more fearful than we need to be of each other for the reasons I just outlined, mm-hmm. that there are a bunch of problems we have in common that we ought to figure out a way to talk about again together. And that's one of the reasons I like that, you know, Murphy and Murthy and Cox are focusing on these problems that everybody can recognize.
Sure.
And that, you know, that there's a great John F. Kennedy line about a small piece of cooperation, I'm missing the word there, pushing back a jungle of suspicion. And he was talking about the Cold War. But I think this is an area where you could begin to push back the jungle of suspicion.
So there
on the
are
other
things
hand,
to be,
but just to answer,
sure, yeah.
to be straight up, am I more fearful about American democracy at the moment? Yes, I am more fearful. I'm more fearful after January 6th. I'm more fearful that if President Trump loses a legitimate election, he will not accept it again. I'm fearful of efforts to keep people from voting. I am worried about the future of our democracy. I think we can make it. If you ask me to place a wager, I'd wager on it, but I'd still worry about the possibility of losing that wager.
I think on that, we should thank EJ for a really wonderful discussion, lecture, conversation.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.